The immediate prospects looked quite good. I kind of think that the decisions taken in the next few weeks will determine the rest of the world for years to come, Blair said. As primary players, we have a chance to shape the issues that are discussed. Both of us will have enormous capital, and a lot of people will be with us. On March 20th, the first full day of the war, General Franks reported that special forces were in partial control of the vast western desert area, 25% of Iraq's territory, which enabled them to prevent Scud missile firings, as well as southern oil fields. A total of 241,516 U.S. military personnel were in the region, joined by some 41,000 from the U.K., 2,000 from Australia, and 200 from Poland. The ground force, U.S. and coalition, numbered 183,000, most of it poised to move north from Kuwait into Iraq, and then the 250 miles to Baghdad. During the nearly 16 months of war planning, Franks had whittled down the air-only phase to 5 days, then to his current plan of just 9 hours of shock and awe bombing and missile strikes, beginning at 1 p.m. Washington time on Friday, March 21st, before the major ground incursion that was scheduled for 10 p.m. Friday night. Franks now proposed an even more radical change: to push the start of the ground war up by 24 hours ahead of the air war. Rumsfeld approved. He had been pushing to make the ground and air campaigns more concurrent. On Saturday, March 22nd, Franks updated the president and the war cabinet at Camp David via video teleconference. In a later call to Blair, the president reported, "The body language of Tommy and all the commanders is pretty positive. They are pleased with the progress, pleased that no WMD has been shot at us, and we are looking and we'll find the stuff." There were some defections of Iraqi military, but not mass surrenders so far, Bush said, and the U.S. wasn't taking prisoners of war. Thousands are just taking off their uniforms and going home. "Yes, they are just melting away," Blair said. "Just melting away," Bush echoed. On Monday morning, March 24th, Putin called Bush. "This is going to be awfully difficult for you," the Russian president said. "I feel bad for you. I feel bad." As they talked, Bush realized that Putin, who was engaged in a bloody war with the Chechen rebels, was expressing concern about the personal toll on him. "Well, thanks for calling," Bush finally said. "You're awfully kind to do that." He later recalled, "It was a genuine call. It wasn't a told you so. It was a friendship call, and I appreciated it." He added, "That's the only call I got along those lines, by the way." Over the next week, U.S. and British forces met with resistance. Foul weather and sandstorms also slowed progress. It became a dark period for Bush and the team, with the army stalled, dozens of Americans killed, some taken prisoner, and the news coverage negative. In a meeting with a group of veterans in the Roosevelt Room on Friday, March 28th, the president said, "I'm not paying attention to the press. It looks like, I don't know what it looks like. I get my information from Tommy Franks." He added, "The important thing is to win the peace. I don't expect Thomas Jefferson to come out of this, but I believe people will be free." The next day, meeting with the National Security Council, Bush touched again on these themes. "Only one thing matters: winning. There's a lot of second-guessing regarding the post-Saddam world. Our job is to speak to the American people, tell them how proud we are of the soldiers, to the world to tell them that we will accomplish this mission. To our European allies, thanks for your help. The Iraqi people, we will be coming to liberate the entire country." He added, "Don't worry about the carping and second-guessing. Rise above it. Be confident. Remember your constituencies. We can't let the press get us to comment on every battlefield development," Powell said. "Stay focused on the big picture." "It's not a matter of timetable," Bush repeated. "It's a matter of victory." Bush spoke to Spanish President Aznar. We are losing one part of the war, and this is propaganda, he said. Iraq was using mobile vans to keep state TV on the air, though Bush told him they were being found and destroyed. The president had become a kind of morale officer to the world leaders and recounted to Asnar a recent conversation with Franks. I said, Tommy, do you have everything you need? And he said, yes, Mr. President. And I said, Tommy, how do you feel? And he said, we are on the way to victory. I know Tommy very well. We are from the same part of Texas. I know when he is telling me the truth and when he is putting some Texas BS on me. And in this case, he's telling the truth. Bush told Australia's John Howard that after a week of bad press, things were looking up. The way I would describe the psychology inside Iraq is that Saddam has his fingers around the throat of the Iraqi people, and he has two of his fingers left, and we are prying them loose. He went on, every speech I give, I remind them of the atrocities of the regime just to make the point that they act like terrorists. The lawyers are saying that we should not say it because of the connotation. He was not supposed to prejudge people who might eventually be tried as war criminals. I can say it is terrorist-like activity, he said, and added, lawyers, they're dreadful. The morning of Wednesday, April 9th, Franks gave the President and the National Security Council an update by secure video. Had a good week. The troops are focused, the morale is good, the locals are remarkable, he said. What was striking were the omissions. There was no talk of Fortress Baghdad, no refugee crisis, and no use of chemical or biological weapons. At one point, Frank said, there are 30,000 Iraqi casualties estimated. In other words, we had just been mowing them down as we're coming in, the president commented later in an interview. He said he had asked if they were civilians or soldiers, and had been told they were soldiers. I mentioned that some generals estimated that 60,000 Iraqi military were killed, but no one knew because they didn't find the bodies. That's what I asked, Bush said. Where are all the bodies? And they answered, with the uniformed divisions, they bury the bodies immediately. In the Muslim tradition, I guess. That day, April 9th, was the symbolic end of Saddam's rule. His government collapsed as the U.S. Army occupied the banks of the Tigris River, and U.S. Marines swept into downtown Baghdad and helped a group of Iraqis topple a 20-foot statue of Saddam. Across the city, thousands of Iraqis took to the streets to rejoice. It seemed to be the sweets and flowers that some had predicted. At 11:27 a.m., Bush spoke with Asnar. The strategy is paying off, the president said. But you won't see us doing any victory dances or anything here because of the northern third of the country. Mosul, Kirkuk, and Tikrit are still in enemy hands. We've still got work to do inside Baghdad, find high-value leadership. 2 days earlier, they had bombed a restaurant where they believed Saddam and his sons were, though they had not yet seen proof that any had survived the first night's attacks. I personally believe we've killed Saddam Hussein twice. I think we killed the real guy the first day, and yesterday we killed the fake. As to weapons of mass destruction, the president said, there's a massive amount of tunnels and caves. We have to control expectations on that. It's going to take a while to dig out the rubble and find where he stored this stuff. The next day, April 10th, Ken Edelman, a Cheney friend and former assistant to Rumsfeld at Defense in the 1970s, published an op-ed article in the Washington Post headlined, Cakewalk Revisited, more or less gloating over what appeared to be the quick victory, and reminding readers that 14 months earlier he had written that war would be a cakewalk. Cheney phoned Edelman, who was in Paris with his wife Carol. What a clever column, the vice president said. He said he and Lynn were having a small private dinner Sunday night, April 13th, to talk and celebrate. The only other guests would be Scooter Libby and Paul Wolfowitz. Edelman realized it was Cheney's way of saying thank you, and he and his wife came back from Paris a day early to attend the dinner. When Edelman walked into the vice president's residence that Sunday night, he was so happy he broke into tears. He hugged Cheney for the first time in the 30 years he had known him. There had been reports in recent days of mass graves and abundant graphic evidence of torture by Saddam's regime, so there was a feeling that they had been part of a greater good, liberating 25 million people. "We're all together. There should be no protocol. Let's just talk," Cheney said when they sat down to dinner. Wolfowitz embarked on a long review of the 1991 Gulf War, and Cheney said he had not realized then what a trauma that time had been for the Iraqis, particularly the Shiites. Hold it," Edelman interjected. "Let's talk about this Gulf War. It's so easy for me to write an article saying, do this. It's much tougher for Paul to advocate it. Paul and Scooter, you give advice inside and the president listens. Dick, your advice is the most important, the Cadillac. But in the end, all of what we said was still only advice. The president is the one who had to decide. I've been blown away by how determined he is." "The war has been awesome," Edelman said. "So I just want to make a toast, without getting too cheesy, to the President of the United States." They all raised their glasses. "Hear, hear." Edelman said he had worried to death as time went on and support seemed to wane that there would be no war. After 9/11, Cheney said, the president understood what had to be done. He had to do Afghanistan first, sequence the attacks. But after Afghanistan, soon thereafter, the president knew he had to do Iraq. Someone mentioned Powell, and there were chuckles around the table. Cheney and Wolfowitz remarked that Powell was sure someone who followed his poll ratings and bragged about his popularity. "He sure likes to be popular," Cheney said. Wolfowitz said that Powell did bring credibility and that his presentation to the United Nations on WMD intelligence had been important. "As soon as Powell had understood what the president wanted," Wolfowitz said, "he became a good, loyal member of the team." Cheney shook his head no. Powell was a problem. "Colin always had major reservations about what we were trying to do." A short time later, Cheney said he had just had lunch with the president. "Democracy in the Middle East is just a big deal for him. It's what's driving him." "Let me ask," Edelman inquired, "before this turns into a love fest, I was just stunned that we have not found weapons of mass destruction." There were several hundred thousand troops and others combing the country. "We'll find them," Wolfowitz said. "It's only been 4 days, really," Cheney said. "We'll find them." President Bush did not take his own advice to avoid victory dances and not be fooled by celebrations. On May 1st, the former Texas Air National Guard jet pilot donned a flight suit and landed on the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, which was at sea just off the coast of San Diego. In an address to the nation from the flight deck, he proclaimed, "Major combat operations in Iraq have ended." Though he was technically correct and did caution, "We have difficult work to do in Iraq," there was no doubt that it was a victory speech. As Bush spoke, a large banner hung in the background, "Mission accomplished." In May 2003, General Garner was replaced by L. Paul Jerry Bremer III, the head of the Coalition Provisional Authority, who was to oversee the rebuilding of Iraq and the eventual transition to democracy. For Bush's team, there was little time for the empty feelings that often follow the conquest. Though in many respects the war was a stunning military victory, the aftermath soon became a continuum of violence and uncertainty. Franks was the first to retire. A number of his subordinate generals and others thought he had blown the stability operations. He believed he had pushed Rumsfeld, Wolfowitz, and General Myers on the post-war plans as much as he could. He had said that the decisive combat operations would go very fast, that they needed to focus on the aftermath. But Rumsfeld and the others had been focused on the war. When major combat was over in May, Franks was exhausted and took a leave. Powell spent the months more often than not on the defensive. To those who thought he should have been a more forceful advocate against war, he replied that he had taken his best shot. "He's the president," Powell told associates. and he decided, and therefore it was my obligation to go down the other fork with him. As the war planning had progressed over the nearly 16 months, Powell had felt that the easier the war looked, the less Rumsfeld, the Pentagon, and Franks had worried about the aftermath. They seemed to think Iraq was a crystal goblet and that all they had to do was tap it and it would crack. It had turned out to be a beer mug instead. Now they owned the beer mug. Visiting Iraq in the fall of 2003, Powell saw the mass graves and heard the testimony of witnesses to the torture and oppression. He was delighted that Saddam and his whole rotten regime were gone. It was the saving grace. Certainly the decision to go to war was not 100% wrong. History, after all, had not yet determined whether it was right or wrong. Armitage was growing increasingly restive. He believed that the foreign policy-making system that was supposed to be coordinated by Rice was essentially dysfunctional. That dysfunction had served well as long as Powell and he could delay war. But that effort had ultimately failed. Later, in 2003, whenever there was a presidential speech or an issue with the White House, particularly on the Middle East, he would say to Powell, "Tell these people to fuck themselves." Powell's response was to soldier on. Months after the war, Rice asked Armitage about his all-too-apparent distress. "The National Security Council system is dysfunctional," he told her bluntly. "The Deputies Committee was not carrying its load. Policy was not sufficiently coordinated, debated, and then settled. She needed to be a good knockdown, drag-out fighter to be a strong security advisor and enforce discipline." Rice said that she was dealing with genuine heavyweights, as Armitage well knew. Cheney, Powell, and Rumsfeld were not shrinking violets, and the president wanted to make sure each had his say. In early October, the president gave Rice new authority and responsibility for coordinating the tremendous task of stabilizing and rebuilding Iraq. Powell thought that now that Bush and the administration had to live with the consequences of their Iraq decisions, they were becoming dangerously protective of those decisions. There was no one in the White House who could break through to insist on a realistic reassessment. There was no Karen Hughes who could go to Bush and say, "Pay attention, you're in trouble." Powell believed it was the hardest of all tasks to go back to fundamentals and question your own judgment. And there was no sign it was going to happen. So he soldiered on once again against the current. Rumsfeld had been the overall manager, the withering interrogator, the defense technocrat who had given the president the plan of attack. Cheney called it Rumsfeld's up-to-his-eyeballs kind of management. Powell, who had seen a fever in Cheney, never detected that in Rumsfeld. If Bush had decided against war, Powell was sure that Cheney, Wolfowitz, and Feith would have wrung their hands and probably would have gone nuts, but not Rumsfeld. When I interviewed Rumsfeld in the fall of 2003, I asked if he wanted a war. "Oh, goodness, no," he said. "No one with any sense wants conflict." "Did you recommend going to war?" He paused. "It's an interesting question. There's no question in anyone's mind, but I agreed with the president's approach and his decision. Whether there ever was a formal moment where he asked me, 'Do I think he should go to war?' I can't recall it." The president later said he had not asked Rumsfeld. But Rumsfeld said the president did ask other key questions that fit with his own definition of his job as secretary. "I can remember him asking me, 'Do I have confidence in General Franks? Do I have confidence in the war plan?'" The president then had to decide who he wanted to give a long leash to and who a shorter leash. He didn't micromanage. "This president has a lot of the same quality that Ronald Reagan did, where he'd look out way out to the horizon and plant a standard out there and then point toward it." Since the burden of the decision to launch a preemptive war is a huge one, I asked if the president ever discussed this with him. "No," Rumsfeld said. "Were there ever any?" "Never," Rumsfeld said. "He carries his responsibilities very well." The president did not worry decisions to death because he had invested the time up front to examine and determine what he wanted and why, Rumsfeld said. Somebody who has not, he said, tends to be uncomfortable with the decisions and can be blown off the wind, blown by the wind and change their mind and be worried and anguished. And his worry and investment was before the fact, not after the fact. Tim, the CIA base chief in northern Iraq, realized that he had lived every operation officer's dream. He had been out on his own, no State Department, no military, nothing, only himself and money. On March 24, 2003, 5 days after the start of the war, Tim made his way down to Dora Farm. The place had been picked pretty clean. There was no bunker nor any hint of one. He found a subterranean pantry for food storage attached to the main house. Perhaps that was what his rock star agents had been referring to. Tim eventually tracked down some of the rock star agents who had reported that night. Two said that their wives had been captured by Saddam's agents and tortured by having their fingernails pulled out. Another maintained that his house had been bulldozed. There was some evidence to support these claims, but Tim was unsure. The more Tim searched his memory and the few documents, he realized that much was cloudy. Everyone had been stressed. The rock stars on the ground had not wanted to disappoint and had obviously been worried about being captured or killed. The biggest unanswered question was, had Saddam and his entourage been there that night? Rice was becoming more and more of a believer in the importance of long-term outcomes. She felt it was important to be patient for the real outcome in Iraq, not just about weapons of mass destruction, but about a political settlement. And that might be quite a bit later. She found some comfort in the fact that the president was holding firm and thinking about the long term. Visiting Japan in October 2003, Bush had told Prime Minister Junichiro Koizumi, "If we hadn't gotten it right in 1945 and helped build a democratically prosperous Japan, our conversation, between a Japanese prime minister and a president of the United States, could never take place. One day, a president of Iraq and a president of the United States are going to be sitting there trying to solve some problem, and they're going to say they're glad we created a democratic and prosperous Iraq." The violence and the insurgency inside Iraq continued, and hundreds of U.S. military personnel and Iraqis were killed. My first interview with President Bush for this book took place Wednesday afternoon, December 10, 2003, in the president's office in the White House residence for more than 1.5 hours. The second was the following afternoon in the Oval Office for more than 2 hours. Rice and Bartlett were present during the interviews. We spent some time discussing Vice President Cheney. In addition to saying that he didn't think the vice president was feverish about Al-Qaeda or Iraq, the president said, "He doesn't want to be viewed as a hero or a villain. He wants to be viewed as a loyal vice president, which he is. And you know, he's got opinions. People appreciate his opinions because Dick's the kind of person who doesn't necessarily talk a lot. But when he does talk, he gives the impression that he is a thoughtful person." I said that Cheney had emerged as a kind of Howard Hughes, the reclusive man behind the scenes who would not answer questions. "That's what I told him," Bush said. He indicated Cheney should get out and do more interviews. "By being silent," Bush said, "there's a danger that you'll either be a heck of a lot more powerful than you are, or a heck of a lot weaker than you are. And it's neither." Detailed questions frightened and scared the heck out of him, the president said. The vice president's tendency to be circumspect was admirable, he added. "That's why I love Cheney." He later added that Cheney is scared to death of any false impressions from material that might be taken out of context or hyped. Cheney doesn't want to be in the middle of any sharp elbows. Bush continued, "I know Cheney well. And he's, by the way, a very good vice president. He wants to be anonymous from that perspective, and he should be. On the other hand, he was a rock. I mean, he was steadfast and steady in his view that Saddam was a threat to America and we had to deal with him." He added, He sees this book coming out in an election, and again, he's worried about it, just to be frank with you. We turn to the question of doubts. I quoted what Tony Blair recently had said at his party's annual conference. I do not at all disrespect anyone who disagrees with me. Blair had also said he had received letters from those who had lost sons in the war who wrote that they hated him for what he did. I quoted Blair, "And don't believe anyone who tells you when they receive letters like that they don't suffer any doubt." "Yeah," President Bush replied. "I haven't suffered doubt." "Is that right?" I asked. "Not at all?" "No, and I'm able to convey that to the people." To those who had lost sons or daughters, he said, "I hope I'm able to convey that in a humble way." I asked about his father in this way. Here is the one living human being who's held this office who had to make a decision to go to war. And it would not be credible if you did not at some point ask him, "What are the ingredients of doing this right? Or what's your thought? This is what I'm facing." "If it wouldn't be credible," Bush replied, "I guess I better make up an answer." "No, no," I said. "I'm being hard and direct because..." "No, no, no," the president replied. "You should be. Look, I talked to him, of course. I cannot remember a moment where he said, 'Don't do this,' or 'Do this.' I can't remember a moment where I said to myself, 'Maybe he can help me make the decision.' Because you got to understand, this decision is not like all of a sudden there is a threat to Kuwait and boom. This is part of a larger obligation that came to be on September the 11th, 2001. This is part of a large and a different kind of war. It's like a front." "Did you say to him, 'Dad, how do I do this right? What should I think about?'" "I don't think I did," he replied. "Did you have any discussion about it?" "I'm confident, sure we did. I'm not trying to be evasive, I don't remember. I could ask him and see if he remembers something. But how do you ask a person, what does it feel like to send somebody in and them lose life? Remember, I've already done so for starters in Afghanistan." "The discussions would be more on the tactics. How are we doing? How are you doing with the Brits?" He's following the news now. "And so I'm briefing him on what I see. You know, he's the wrong father to appeal to in terms of strength. There is a higher father that I appeal to." I mentioned that one of my bosses at the Washington Post had suggested a tough question on weapons of mass destruction. "Was the president misled?" "No," the president said. "By the intelligence, or did he mislead the country?" "No," he said. "The answer is absolutely not." "What happened?" "What do you mean by what happened?" "In terms of the weapons of mass destruction and the slam dunk case that Tenet had promised. If the large number of violations of UN resolutions reported by David Kaye in October 2003 had been known before the war," the president said, "it would have established material breach and provided a cause for war. But I think it's way too early to fully understand the complete history." "But we have not found any weapons of mass destruction," I said. "We have found weapons programs," Bush said, "that could be reconstituted." "Could be, I agree," I said. "An actual weapon could be built very quickly," he said. "And so therefore, given that, even if that's the very minimum you had, how could you not act on Saddam Hussein? That's my answer." I said that after 9/11, he had been the voice of realism, telling the country after the catastrophic attack that it would be a long and difficult war. From my travels, I said many people, including his supporters, were saying he was less the voice of realism for not saying and acknowledging that the weapons had not yet been found. "I don't want people to say, 'Aha, we told you so.' I want people to know that there is a process that's ongoing," he said, adding that not one person had suggested to him that he make such an acknowledgement. "But you run in different circles than I do, much more elite." "It's really lots of business groups," I said. "The realism," the president said, "is to be able to understand that nature of Saddam Hussein, his history, his potential harm to America." I said I was trying to address the simple fact that no weapons of mass destruction had been found. "We haven't found bubbling baths." He chuckled. "But the status report," I said, "for the last 6 or 7 months is we haven't found weapons, that's all." True, 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 he said. He contended that they had found enough. The person who wants the president to stand up and declare that publicly is also the person who wants to say, shouldn't have done it. And there is no doubt in my mind we should have done this, not only for our own sake, but for the Iraqi citizens. I'm probably sounding incredibly defensive all of a sudden, he added coolly. The failure to find the bubbling vat did not render Saddam benign. I said I was asking these questions because I wanted to show in the book what he thought the status of the weapons of mass destruction search was. Why do you need to deal with this in the book? He asked. What's this got to do about it? I said that I had to cover the aftermath of the war. This was a key question. The president said he wanted to make sure that his acknowledgement that no weapons of mass destruction had been found so far would not be published in the Washington Post until the book was released. In other words, I'm not going to read a headline, Bush says no weapons. I promised that he would not. Did he feel there was any miscalculation about how long it would take to stabilize and pacify Iraq after the war? No, he said. I think I was pretty well prepared for a pretty long haul. Many positive things have occurred, he said. He noted that the Iraqi oil fields have been successfully protected, mass hunger avoided, and a new currency introduced, which was itself an impressive feat, he said. The major issues that we thought we'd be confronted with just didn't happen. The violence, he said, was mostly in about 5 to 10% of Iraq. It's dangerous because there are still enough thugs and assassins there that can do you in. But it's still tough. There's still loss of life. He said he was optimistic about the outlook. It's just a matter of time. It's a matter of society evolving. It's a matter of a sovereignty issue evolving, when the government would be turned over to the Iraqi people. He said the liberation was changing a mentality. Iraqis would soon be on the front line of the police work, and would be the ones to go after the assassins, along with Iraqi troops. He complained that some of the positive things in Iraq did not get coverage in the American media. What matters is the emergence of a free society where people realize their lives are better off, and where they work through their trauma so they can seize the moment. Summarizing at the end of our first interview, he said of the war and the aftermath, "It is the story of the 21st century." He continued about his own brief visit to Iraq 2 weeks earlier. And when I went there in Thanksgiving, I went to thank the troops, but I also went to say to the Iraqi people, seize the moment, this is your country. During a successful transition to self-government, the key would be minority rights for those groups and tribes that were not Shiites, and a clear understanding that vengeance and jealousy won't rule the day. The president said he believed the record would show that he, Rumsfeld, Franks, and the other military people developed a war plan that carefully targeted Saddam, the Ba'athist leadership and inner circle, and their means to retain power. The war was precisely directed at them and that apparatus, military, security service, secret police. As much as possible, average Iraqis were spared. It would be a blueprint of historical significance that, he said, will enable other leaders, if they feel like they have to go to war, to spare innocent citizens and their lives. Telling that story was one of the chief reasons the president said he had agreed to be interviewed in depth about the war, and why he wanted Rumsfeld and others in the administration to answer my questions. But the news of this, in my judgment, the big news out of this isn't how George W. makes decisions, he said. To me, the big news is America has changed how you fight and win war, and therefore makes it easier to keep the peace in the long run. And that's the historical significance of this book as far as I'm concerned. The president reminded me that back in his private office, he keeps a brick brought back by the Special Forces unit that had conducted the first U.S. military raid into Afghanistan after 9/11. It was from the compound of Taliban leader Mullah Omar. It was a reminder, he said, that when he put boots on the ground and ordered direct ground engagement, U.S. military personnel would die. It was not the antiseptic war of shooting cruise missiles that protects U.S. military personnel. A president must be steeled to deal with the casualties that inevitably come from a strategy aimed to win the war, Bush said. And I mean there will be death. And particularly if you are aiming to free an entire nation of people, there will be death. In Iraq, with nearly 200,000 U.S. military personnel on the ground, he said, I knew there would be casualties, and that brick reminds me of that. 2 days later, December 13th, the U.S. military captured Saddam Hussein, unshaven and apparently disoriented, pulling him from a hole near a farmhouse outside Tikrit. The next day, Sunday, the president addressed the nation. The capture of this man was crucial to the rise of a free Iraq, Bush said. It marks the end of the road for him and for all who bullied and killed in his name. He added, a dark and painful era is over, but cautioned, the capture of Saddam Hussein does not mean the end of violence in Iraq. The failure to find weapons of mass destruction and the continuing violence and instability inside Iraq, the fact that the war was not really over, was giving pause even to the true believers, none more so than Wolfowitz, who for many years had been an outspoken and persistent advocate for ousting Saddam. Wolfowitz found himself asking with some frequency whether the war had been worth it. The question arose most painfully at the funeral of Army Lieutenant Colonel Chad Burring, who was killed on the floor right below Wolfowitz when his hotel in Baghdad was attacked in late 2003, and during the dozen or more times he visited wounded servicemen at military hospitals. But despite his anguish over the ongoing violence, Wolfowitz held firmly to the belief that the war was justified and worthwhile, and that the decision was an act of personal courage by the president. Wolfowitz was confident this war would be seen as an essential stage in the march toward human freedom, democracy, and the defeat of terrorism from which Americans would benefit. Senator Bob Graham, the Florida Democrat who in 2003 made a brief run for the Democratic presidential nomination, thought the war in Iraq was one of the most serious errors of American foreign policy since World War II. It was as if the United States had gone to war against Mussolini's Italy in 1941 instead of Hitler's Germany. Graham believed that the Hitlers of terrorism were Al-Qaeda and Hezbollah, extremists backed by Iran. Both posed greater threats than Iraq. Both had the capability and the will to attack and had a covert presence within the U.S., he believed. On the WMD issues, Graham thought the CIA had used bad intelligence, and then the administration, the president included, had manipulated and hyped it. He believed Tenet should have resigned or been fired. He felt the president should have stood up and taken responsibility for the errors. In the 2004 election, he hoped the American voters would agree with him and remove Bush from office. At the beginning of 2004, Cheney was confident that the Iraq War would be seen as a history-shaping event. He was unrepentant about his analysis of terrorism and his assertions about Saddam. Cheney believed that given the intelligence reporting about Iraq, Al-Qaeda links over so many years, and the intelligence evidence on weapons of mass destruction, no one in his right mind sitting in Bush's position as president could have ignored it. Cheney also was convinced that Bush had an abiding faith that if people were given freedom and democracy, that would begin a transformation process in Iraq that in years ahead would change the Middle East. There was so much focus on the aftermath and criticism of the post-war planning. Cheney thought it wouldn't matter in the end. It would be noise to history as long as they were successful in what they were trying to do. Outcomes mattered. He thought history would treat Bush very well, though he acknowledged that the jury was still out. Karl Rove had come to love Cheney. On a few occasions, Rove and the president had discussed the news stories that Cheney was really pulling the strings and running things behind the scenes. Bush laughed. Both of them had seen how deferential Cheney was. Yes, Mr. President, or no, Mr. President. It was no different when the president and Cheney were alone. When the president wasn't around, Cheney often referred to him as the man. saying that the man wants this, or the man thinks this. Cheney was a forceful, persistent advocate, but the president decided. By early February 2004, Rove could see that Iraq was turning into a potential negative. The violence on the ground continued. The failure to find any weapons of mass destruction, and Bush's and Tenet's public acknowledgments that the intelligence might have been wrong, were potentially big setbacks. The good news for us is that Howard Dean is not the nominee, Rove now argued to an associate in his second-floor West Wing office. One of Dean's strengths, though, was he could say, "I'm not part of that crowd down there." The record was that John Kerry had been all over the map. Kerry would have, and did have, answers. His main response was that Bush did not press hard enough or long enough with the UN, that he did not build a legitimate global coalition, that he did not plan for the aftermath, and was too eager to go to war when Saddam was isolated and weak. But Rove believed they had Kerry pretty cold on voting to give the president a green light for war and then backing off when he didn't like the aftermath or saw a political opportunity. Whatever the case, Rove sounded as if he believed they could inoculate the president on the Iraq war in a campaign with Kerry. It remained to be seen, but Rove was certainly going to try. For Armitage, soldiering on had its limits. Powell and he were fighting the good fight, attempting at every possible turn to soften the appearance and reality of unilateralism and arrogance in Bush administration foreign policy. But Armitage didn't think that either Powell or he came off as soldier of the year or even of the month. A close friend of Armitage's from Congress told him that he and Powell had really failed. They had become the enablers, providing cover and an appearance of reasonableness so Cheney and Rumsfeld could work their will. Armitage didn't think his friend from Congress was wrong. In moments of his own despondency, he looked back on his 3 years at State and could find redeeming moments only in his personal relationship with Powell as they had tried to solve problems by using diplomacy, not war. Armitage found two significant lingering difficulties from the Iraq War. Though he believed they would put down the insurgency and win in the end, the U.S. military was going to pay for 10 years or more. The Army, in particular, was stretched too thin. The second problem was political. Armitage did not see what would come to pass in Iraq or elsewhere in the remaining 8 months before the presidential election that would alter the perception that Bush was in a jam. On Wednesday, January 28, 2004, David Kaye, who had recently resigned as head of the Iraqi Survey Group, told the Senate Armed Service Committee that "we were almost all wrong, and I certainly include myself." He said that 85% of the work was done, and he did not expect ever to find WMD stockpiles in Iraq. Pressure mounted from both Democrats and Republicans for an independent investigation. Bush initially said no, but then he, Cheney, Rice, and others in the White House quickly grasped the necessity and the opportunity. So they decided to seize the initiative and propose an independent, bipartisan commission. The commission would not report until sometime after the presidential election. On Monday, February 2nd, after a cabinet meeting, a reporter asked the president, "Do you think that the country is owed an explanation about the Iraq intelligence failure before the election so that voters have this information when they elect a new president?" "First of all, I want to know all the facts," Bush said, noting that they were not all in, and he did not answer the question. Powell was surprised that Kaye had not gone quietly. He spent some time going through the transcript of Kaye's Armed Services Committee testimony. It certainly showed that Saddam had the intent and the capability to produce weapons of mass destruction, but the absence of actual stockpiles of biological and chemical weapons was a big problem and could not be dismissed. The administration had to face the new reality. There was an entirely different set of facts regarding one of the key reasons for war. After the cabinet meeting on February 2nd, Powell, carrying a fully annotated transcript of Kay's statement, met with a group of editors and reporters from the Washington Post for an interview. I did not attend. Powell defended Bush's war decision, saying, "It was the right thing to do." If Tenet had said before the war started what Dr. Kay has now said about there being no actual stockpiles, one questioner asked, would you still have recommended the invasion? I don't know, Powell replied, because it was the stockpile that presented the final little piece that made it more of a real and present danger and threat to the region and to the world. He added, the absence of a stockpile changes the political calculus. It changes the answer you get. The secretary's remarks were the lead story in the Post the next day. Powell says new data may have affected war decision. Rice had already discussed Powell's comments with the president when she called him that morning. Both the president and she were mad, she told the secretary of state. Powell had given the Democrats a remarkable tool. Rice's message was clear. Get in line. At 10:45 that morning, as Powell was leaving the State Department for the White House to meet with the President and UN Secretary General Kofi Annan, he was asked by reporters about his remarks to the Post. He did not repeat them. He made an extraordinary statement that even if they had had other information, presumably something like Kay's assessment before the war, it would not have changed the war decision. It was something we all agreed to and would probably agree to again under any other set of circumstances. The president was stalwart that they absolutely had done the right thing in removing Saddam. The war cabinet had all signed on. They were a team. The larger message was clear. Circle the wagons. It had taken a long time for Tenet to come to grips with the enormity of his problem. A month after major combat had ended, he was not worried that they had not found weapons of mass destruction. They would find it for sure, he thought, though it might take months. The WMD issue pulsed in the background for 10 months until Kay's resignation and declaration that they had all been wrong. This put Tenet in a bind. Tenet had been privately very critical of news stories that had been wrong or overreaching about a possible quagmire in the Afghanistan war in late 2001. There's never any price, he had said, when the media is wrong. He said that if the CIA director had given out equivalent bad information, the president should fire your ass. But no one at the CIA was paying a price or being held accountable for what seemed to be a mistake. And Tenet was the one who had assured Bush that the case on weapons of mass destruction was a slam dunk. I'm not a fool, Tenet told associates in one breath, and in the next said the failure to find weapons of mass destruction was weird. He knew his head could go on the chopping block. Tenet decided to launch a defense. On February 5, 2004, the 1-year anniversary of Powell's WMD presentation to the UN, he made a rare public speech at Georgetown University. We are nowhere near 85% finished, he said of the WMD search, directly disputing Kay's public statement. The CIA was reviewing and examining everything in order to improve its performance, and had discovered that one of their sources had fabricated information, Tenet said. During the ongoing investigations and reviews, they would have to be careful, he warned. We cannot afford an environment to develop where analysts are afraid to make a call, where judgments are held back because analysts fear they will be wrong. In a sense, Tenet was asking that there be little or no price to pay for being wrong. Given the aftermath of 9/11 and the ongoing Al-Qaeda threat, the CIA had adopted a mentality of warning at any cost. Of course, it was one thing to be wrong about warning of an attack on the United States. But being wrong about information that Saddam possessed biological and chemical weapons, the basis for war, could hardly leave anyone satisfied and comfortable. As Tenet went over the intelligence again and again, he acknowledged to associates that the CIA and he should have stated up front in the National Intelligence Estimate and in other intelligence that the evidence was not ironclad, that it did not include a smoking gun. Holy shit, Powell said to himself as he read a copy of Tenet's speech. Here was the CIA director saying that the aluminum tubes they had previously been so confident were for use as centrifuges for enriching uranium were possibly for regular artillery shells. Powell felt let down. Tenet was also backing away from previous assertions of certainty on the alleged mobile biological labs. Powell let out another holy shit. He knew very well that Tenet had told the president in brash New York language, as Powell once put it, that the case on weapons of mass destruction was a slam dunk. He knew that Tenet felt bad, but this was a real mess. Powell did not share Armitage's concern that the two of them had been enablers for the Cheney-Rumsfeld hardline policies. When he sorted out all the issues, Powell felt that the State Department had done a good job and did not get sufficient credit for some of its successes, such as improved relationships with China and Russia. Whenever anyone suggested that Powell should have pangs of conscience on the war, Powell said he had done everything in his power. In August 2002, he had nearly broken his spear, laying before the president all the difficulties of a war, the potential consequences and downsides. It was at a time when he thought the president was not getting the whole picture. He had warned the president. It was the president's decision, not his. Now the United States owned Iraq. Bush owned it. But Powell felt he had done his job. After Tenet's speech, the president had one message for his intelligence chief. "You did a great job," Bush told Tenet in a phone call. For Rice, the process of going to war had been hard, and she thought it should be hard. The aftermath was troubling, particularly the failure to find weapons of mass destruction. She knew that intelligence is not fact. But Cheney had effectively preempted that issue on August 26, 2002, when he declared that there was no doubt Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. And the president had soon followed with his own statements of certainty, even before the CIA's October National Intelligence Estimate was issued. As the WMD controversy grew in 2004, the president expressed his concerns to Rice. To air all of the CIA's problems could have two negatives that he wanted to avoid. First, he did not want a new witch hunt, mindful of the history of investigations that he believed had demoralized the workforce and made the CIA risk-averse for a long time. Second, Bush did not want a future president hampered if there was a need to take preemptive action against another threat. At 1:30 p.m., Friday, February 6th, the president appeared in the press briefing room to announce what was now old news. He said he would appoint a 9-member commission to look at American intelligence capabilities and the intelligence about weapons of mass destruction worldwide. Then the president added, "Members of the commission will issue their report by March 31, 2005. One theme that emerged repeatedly in all the hours I spent interviewing the president and the hundreds of hours I spent interviewing others close to him or involved in the Iraq War decisions is Bush's conviction that he made the right decision. In the second interview with him, December 11, 2003, the president said he had once told Rice, "I am prepared to risk my presidency to do what I think is right. I was going to act, and if it could cost the presidency, I fully realized that. But I felt so strongly that it was the right thing to do that I was prepared to do so." I asked if, as I had heard, he had said at one of the meetings in the run-up to war, "I would like to be a 2-term president, but if I am a 1-term president, so be it." "That's right," the president replied. "That is my attitude, absolutely right." He noted that things could have gone wrong on the ground in the run-up, or they could have become trapped with endless UN weapons inspections. "And if this decision costs you the election?" I asked. "The presidency?" "That's just the way it is," Bush said. "Fully prepared to live with it." That day, after 2 hours, we stood in the Oval Office and started to walk out. Darkness was beginning to settle in outside. The upcoming presidential election would perhaps be the most immediate judgment on the war, but certainly not the last. How would history judge his Iraq War? I asked. It would be impossible to get the meaning right in the short run, the president said, adding he thought it would take about 10 years to understand the impact and the true significance of the war. There will probably be cycles, I said. As Karl Rove believes, I reminded him, all history gets measured by outcomes. Bush smiled. History, he said, shrugging, taking his hands out of his pockets, extending his arms out, and suggesting with his body language that it was so far off. We won't know. We'll all be dead.
Plan of Attack was written by Bob Woodward and read by Boyd Gaines. It was abridged for audio by George Truitt. Post-production by Stephen Strassman, with additional editing by Common Mode. The associate producer was Ellen Hurst. Plan of Attack was produced and directed by Elisa Shokoff. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.